On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The 2006 winner of the Nobel Prize for Economics, American Edmund Phelps, wasted no time in speaking his mind after the honors were announced in Stockholm last week. The next day, he was in print celebrating the dynamism and innovation of American capitalism. Not that it's perfect, he said, but it sure beats Europe's social market economy, class rigidity, and high unemployment. So hooray for the joy of capitalism. But don't self-congratulate too hard, warns Phelps. The wages of America's poor are too low, he says. So are its taxes and its savings. Up next on Point, Nobel Prize winner Edmund Phelps on American capitalism as we live it. Joining me now from Columbia University in New York City is Edmund Phelps, winner just last week of the 2006 Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Science. We duly note that this is not one of the prizes originally established in 1895 by Alfred Nobel, but it comes from Stockholm in his honor with a $1.4 million purse and Nobel Prize accolades. Edmund Phelps, welcome and congratulations. It's been a long time coming.
Thanks very much, Tom.
You did your original work behind this prize in the 1960s, looking at inflation and unemployment, kind of delinking the two. Is the work that you did then still at work today in Ben Bernanke's shop?
I think so. You don't hear them often talking about their intellectual roots, but I think it has a lot of influence in all the central banks of the world. I was very pleased when I heard Mervyn King, the governor of the Bank of England, saying that my ideas were central to their way of thinking.
And, of course, the word from Stockholm, some of the biggest thinking, the most important thinking in half a century done by you, Edmund Phelps. It's a great compliment and a great prize, and we congratulate you on it. You came right out of the blocks the next day in the Wall Street Journal op-ed page with a great sort of ode to the joys of capitalism here, and dynamic capitalism in particular. And you went right at this comparison of the American economies and I should add Canada's and the UK's with that of continental Europe, drew a very grand contrast there. I wish you'd describe it for us. What do you see here, and why is it important for us to contemplate it?
Well, I see the American system as marked by its openness to new commercial ideas, to innovation. And much of that innovation comes from established companies, to be sure, but a lot of the most radical new innovative ideas come from small startup, early stage companies.
You contrast this with Europe, and what happens there? Yeah.
The economies are dominated by big established companies. there are also employer confederations and groupings of big companies. In most of those economies, big monopolistic banks and some small monopolistic banks, and then of course also big labor unions. So it's a system that in which what they call stakeholders and the social partners have a big role to play in vetoing new directions and in talking out what they want to do.
So you describe a picture in which in the American system you've got kind of renegades or entrepreneurs and investment capital hooking up and going after innovation, whatever that may mean, whatever disruption that may mean for the economy,
right.
Americans taking that, living with it, and prospering by it. And on the other side, committees signing off on innovation and maybe rejecting it if it looks like it may turn over too many apple carts. And then you make a really nuanced kind of argument about which is better. Take us into that, if you would.
I say that what the American system is good at is dynamism. I use that word to refer to the fertility of the American economy and coming up with innovative ideas that are of course, technologically feasible and commercially profitable. The Europeans thought that they were going to be able, through a different route, to achieve even more dynamism. They thought that the state could organize the scientific resources of the country, and in that way they could come up with some big new technological breakthroughs and eventually leave the capitalistic countries in the dust. That was in the 20s and 30s, but didn't work out that way. And what we've seen over and over again is that relying on little commercially minded entrepreneurs and the later development work by big companies, that produces a lot more, much more innovativeness.
And
much better direction of innovation than we find in Europe.
You know, what I loved, Edmund Phelps, is here you are, even with your brand new Nobel Prize and all your experience and your deep investment in studying capitalism, American style, but you don't just write off the European one. You really sort of weigh this out, and it's a fascinating weighing. I mean, you acknowledge, you go back and quote D.H. Lawrence talking about America's everlasting slog, because the disruption that comes along with all this innovation can be tremendous. And, you know, thousands and thousands of our listeners know that very intimately and personally. How do you make that final judgment? Because Americans can visit Europe, and it's quite lovely, and people seem to take long lunches. And if they have a job, they seem to have tremendous job security. So they're, you know, if you look at it in terms of comfiness, sometimes you can look across the Atlantic and say, well, you know, that doesn't look so bad. Take us to the fine points of your calculation here, where the American disruption is worth it in the face of what looks like that gemütlich, you know, European comfy life.
Yeah, I agree with you. Americans who go to Europe as tourists come away thinking, gee, they would be glad to trade away the system here for all that easy living. But the more and more we study the subject of economic performance on the continent, the more we see that it really falls short. That includes productivity, for example. I mean, I don't think that productivity is the end-all and be-all of economic performance, but it's important, no doubt. And the U.S. economy and Canada have higher productivity levels than the big three on the continent, Germany, France, and Italy.
Mm. But even with
that, another reason I think that high, and some people say, like D.H. Lawrence, they would say, well, that productivity is not important. But actually, I think it does have a lot of social importance, because if productivity in a country is generally high, so that wage rates are generally high, then people far down the wage scale can afford to take jobs that are less tedious, less dangerous, and maybe more formative. Because it's not so hard to make enough to eat.
But Europe doesn't look like it's starving when we look at Europeans. I mean, another piece that you bring into this, I mean, you describe this fascinating picture where the U.S. with its dynamism produces innovation, which kind of leads the whole economy forward. Here's Europe then, as I read it anyway, in your view, kind of riding in the backdraft of that. It's not as though when you look at their economic numbers that they're doing so badly. So America takes the kind of bumps and thrill ride of the roller coaster while they, in a more stately economy, march on behind. In the end, you put your thumb on the scales for the actual joy of that innovation, not just the standard of living, but you say it's the kind of joy in life of the entrepreneur that can't or shouldn't be stifled if you want to look at the justice of all this.
Yeah, that's exactly where my emphasis is. In an innovative economy such as the American one, the challenges that come up as the entrepreneur is developing a new idea and later trying to market it and get its acceptance in the marketplace, these challenges provide mental stimulation for all the employees working on the project. It sparks problem solving. It creates employee engagement, and leads to personal growth. Now, and I know that meets a lot of skepticism. People say, "Oh, come on! Nobody's going to get personal development out of his job."
I'm thinking of somebody way down the line at Tyson Foods processing chickens in Arkansas, pulling out chicken guts and trying to figure out
the chicken feathers. Yeah. But compared to what? Where else are you going to find such stimulation and challenges in the American economy? The marketplace is rapidly evolving.
In just a few minutes, former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich will join us to mix it up with Edmund Phelps, but you're welcome right now. Sam's calling from Lincoln, Massachusetts. Hi, Sam, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I've always wanted to ask a fellow like this.
A Nobel Prize-winning economist, yes.
Well, I got to tell you that when I hear all these words about productivity, my eyes just glaze over. And let me tell you where I'm looking from. I'm in my 50s. And it looks to me like when we think of U.S. prosperity and the promise and the American way, it's all based on my father's generation. In other words, that period of American history that was after World War II and ended sometime around the Vietnam War. And I'm looking at real simple stuff, not up productivity or happiness.
Such as?
Well, my father was a librarian. My mother didn't work. We lived in a very good community with excellent schools. My father raised a family with three kids. We had two cars in the garage. We went on vacation every summer. We never worried about how we're going to pay our health care bills. And my father worked 40 hours a week.
One income, one librarian, three kids, two cars in the garage, and you're asking where that's gone. Edmund Phelps, what do you say to Sam?
I really have no idea what to say to Sam. It's clear that compensation per hour, the amount of money adjusted for inflation that companies shell out per employee is vastly higher than it was a generation ago and way, way higher than two generations ago.
So when Americans complain about not being able to make it on one income,
what has happened, I think, is that medical insurance has taken a larger and larger slice out of that total compensation, leaving a smaller and smaller proportion of total compensation left over for the paycheck. So that we're all feeling a little bit cash short, even though we have some pretty marvelous health care.
Does that factor into an economist's view of the world? You write about, you wonder and think about why Europeans are so down on dynamic capitalism, but there's a vein of complaint among Americans themselves these days, and you just hear it here from Sam. You trace it back to as simple as that, to health care costs, or is there something else going on here?
Well, the other thing that's going on is there has been a decline of pay rates at the bottom relative to pay rates at the middle, and even more strongly relative to pay rates at the high end. And that started in the late 1970s, and it hasn't quit yet. It seems to be we've finally gotten a bottoming out now. That remains to be seen. In the past couple of years, this trend seems to have at least paused. But so, we've had widening wage inequality in the past 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a cause of enormous concern to me. But I've worked on it for a decade.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just lip service.
Mm-hmm.
But things would not be better if we had in the United States had we embraced the continent's corporatist system. Look, they have massive unemployment now.
No kidding, and have for a long time.
And the socialist economies in Eastern Europe ran into enormous difficulties. That's why they collapsed.
So
we didn't collapse. We're going pretty well. What we have to do is address this problem of wage rates at the bottom relative to wage rates in the middle. And I've been advocating low-wage employment subsidies paid to the firms for every ongoing low-wage employee on the books.
So actually public support through the firm.
That would pick up the demand for low-wage workers, and that would pull up their employment and pull up their paychecks.
Edmund Phelps, I want to hold Sam's lament for a moment, get another perspective from a caller in Amherst, New York. John is on the line. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom and guest. I'm not a Nobel Prize-winning economist. I'm just a simple guy here from Western New York.
Good to have you.
But
what
I'm
do you see?
I'm from the Milton Friedman Nobel Prize type of scenario. We don't have unbridled capitalism in this country. When 30 to 40% of all the wealth is usurped by the government, that hardly makes for, like, the free market that he talks about. But what I'm going to talk about specifically is capitalism. I'm in Western New York. If everyone knows, we just had this freak storm that dumped 2 feet.
2 feet on Buffalo and more, yeah.
Absolutely. What happened is that we're out of power. There are still people who are going to be out of power for several days.
Mm-hmm.
But what has happened is that in the past few days, we have literally thousands of generators. By anyone who could figure out that, hey, you know what, they need them there, I'm going to get them there. If we left this in the hands of the government, I'll guarantee we'll sit there, have a committee, get bids, all of a sudden see how we can do to fill this void where people would be sitting there suffering while the government sticks with the thumb of its proverbial butt.
So with 2 feet of snow, the private generators keeping the lights on in your house, and you're saying why not an even freer market right across even this economy. Edmund Phelps, how about it? What about the constraints on U.S. capitalism? Do you agree with John? Would you like to see even fewer?
Well, as a matter of fact, I may be crazy, but I think my guess is that things could be done to make America's capitalism more dynamic, so that we don't have to wait for something colossal like an internet revolution to cause a surge of investment activity and a surge in productivity. So, I think we should be looking to make sure that we're giving every opportunity for new entrepreneurial ideas. We should be looking at the financial sector, see whether that's whether there's a major room for improvement there. I'm surprised, though, to hear it suggested that we have too much state ownership in this economy. I don't think we don't have very many state enterprises. Maybe the caller means that there's a too much regulation in some industries, so that in general, we've been leaders in returning to private ownership, and on the whole, that seems to have worked out well.
Edmund Phelps, please stand by in New York. I want to invite into our conversation, if I may, joining us from Berkeley, California, Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration, 93 to 97. He's professor of public policy at UC Berkeley, author of Reason and The Work of Nations, Preparing Ourselves for 21st Century Capitalism. Robert Reich, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
It's great to have you with us. You've been listening along. You know the work of Edmund Phelps, and no doubt you've seen him celebrating dynamic capitalism in the Wall Street Journal, and many Americans do. At the same time, he points to low-wage issues. We hear the lament from one of our callers saying, you know what, it seems harder than it was from my parents. So how do you see it, Robert Reich? Is the dynamism working for the country? Do we need even freer capitalism in this country to make it work better, or something closer to Europe?
Well, first of all, let me add my congratulations to Professor Phelps for a very well-deserved Nobel Prize. His contributions to the field of economics and inflation and income and so many areas have been unparalleled, and he could not be a more deserving Nobel Prize winner. Let me just say that with regard to the contrast that Professor Phelps draws between European capitalism and American capitalism as of 2006, there is certainly something to it. We are much more dynamic. There's much more innovation here. Europe is kind of old Europe. I mean, Europe has chosen a different path. I'm not sure it's less successful in terms of life choices. That is, undoubtedly, job satisfaction, as Professor Phelps says, is lower in Europe. But the question is life satisfaction. Europeans, according to some surveys, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development puts out, actually seem to be less stressed. Although more of them lack jobs, those who lack jobs have more unemployment insurance and richer unemployment insurance, life seems to be for Europeans more stable than it is for many Americans. Now, that's not necessarily good or bad. I'm just suggesting that Europe has chosen a different trade-off. Europe seems to want more stability, more social tranquility at the cost of maybe some economic growth and some more jobs, that is, more unemployment. The United States has chosen, whether we are explicitly aware of the choice or not, has chosen a different route, which is more dynamism, more economic growth, but also wider inequality, less stability, kind of a wilder ride for many people. And that is neither good or bad. I think it reflects a social choice that reflects the differences fundamentally in these two different places. You know, America is a culture of impertinence. In America, you don't ask before you do something. You do it, and then you find out if somebody objects. In Europe, you don't do something new. You ask first. You get permission. That's deeply embedded as a difference between these two cultures. We have a culture of impertinence. Mm-hmm. I'm glad I live here, but most Europeans are glad they live there.
Edmund Phelps, what about life satisfaction versus job satisfaction? Robert Reich suggests maybe, you know, maybe they're not quite as happy with their jobs, but maybe on the whole, they're happier with the whole package.
Well, these were stimulating remarks by Secretary Reich, as always. I think I disagree a little bit. I don't think that the Europeans ever made a conscious choice between stability on the one hand and an exciting life with opportunities for self-realization and so forth on the other hand. I think they thought they could have stability cost-free. And as they went through the glorious years of catch-up between the mid-50s and the mid-70s, it seemed that that illusion was borne out. They could have high employment and have their employment stability and welfare state at the same time. But then now it's becoming pretty clear to them that they can't. And another thing I would say is that look at the youth. They're voting with their feet. They're thinking with a different assumption set now, and they're thinking they can't have stability and self-realization and an adventurous life at the same time, simultaneously. They've got to choose, and the youth of France and to some extent Germany are taking off to Ireland and maybe Sweden and the United States and UK to get more arresting involving work.
We're talking with the newly minted Nobel Prize winner in economics, Edmund Phelps, and former Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's take a call from Peabody, Massachusetts. And Jay, hi, Jay, you're on the air. What do you hear?
Hi. Excuse me. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
You know, I guess some of my points were addressed by Sam, but I think I can pretty much chime in and say the same thing, which is, you know, there may be faults to every system, but it seems like the Europeans are living more of a life, in other words, away from work, and not defining themselves by their work. And if the payback is a little bit of unemployment, and I think there's a lot of reasons for that, and some of them can be pointed towards the immigration problems in Europe from a lot of low-wage countries, and they get a lot more of that than we do.
We got quite a bit, but yeah, okay.
Yeah, we get our share as well, but it's more from one source.
But what about your personal fulfillment? Edmund Phelps points to that and says, you know, at work, Americans, they're in the midst of more exciting environments, and so they just feel better about it.
Well, you know, I guess that goes back to the whole, you know, I used to date an Irish girl, and she used to tell me all the time that, you know, people in Europe work to live, not live to work. and here it's the other way around, you know. And I think that there's a lot of truth to that. I think a lot of people get sucked into cell phones on vacations and laptops in the bathroom, and there's no escape from work. There's no way to get away from it. It's all about productivity and squeezing that last cent out of everything that you can do.
Right. Dynamism, that's exciting, but may come right down your throat as well. We'll turn to Edmund Phelps on that. But Robert Reich, first to you. You listen to Americans and write about Americans a lot and their thoughts about work and life. I mean, do you see satisfaction growing, shrinking? We've had two calls here saying, this productivity is not necessarily making me happier.
Well, I think a lot of it depends, Tom, on whether you are a professional who has a lot of responsibility, sitting behind a computer, a creative worker, a knowledge worker, a symbolic analyst, or on the other hand, whether you're an hourly worker in retail, restaurant, hotel, hospital, child care, elder care. I mean, most of the new jobs being created in the United States are unfortunately not the dynamic sort. They are the drudge sort. And Professor Phelps expresses understandable concern, as I have, for people at the bottom. But there are a lot of people in the middle and just below the middle who are finding their wages going absolutely nowhere. In fact, adjusted for inflation, hourly wage growth, that is 80% of our workers are hourly workers, they get paid on an hourly basis, they have seen no increase in the last 30 years adjusted for inflation in their wages, and many of their benefits are disappearing, which is why you need two incomes in so many families to support a family that used to be able to get by on one income. And we haven't seen this degree of inequality since the 1920s. The top 1% is now taking most of the gains of our productivity over the last few years. In fact, the last data I've seen suggests that the top 1% is now taking home roughly 19% of all national income. Now, as late as 1980, they took home about 8% of national income.
Edmund Phelps, Robert Reich, let's hear from a couple more of our listeners. Alex in Hagerstown, Maryland. Alex, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you, and congratulations to Mr. Phelps for his Nobel Prize.
Absolutely, hooray!
And, anyway, so what I wanted to say is, I just recently moved here from New Jersey. I've had countless warehouse jobs. I have no stability whatsoever. They want you to pay into insurance. They want you to pay into this and that and any kind of benefit. They want you to pay into it. By the time you finish paying everything, you don't have money to survive. You're not, I don't feel any job stability. And basically, I'm an aspiring professional working, blue-collar jobs, and I'm having a hard time just, coping with life because I'm so stressed, worried about if I'm going to have a job, from one day to the next, because they want you to work. It's always, first or second shift. It's never first shift. And, I just want to be stable. I want to enjoy my life. I can't enjoy my life if I'm not stable. I don't care what job it is. I just want to be stable, and we don't have that stability here. And it's upsetting me that this guy is saying that. He should come here and work, and then maybe he'll see. Maybe he'll change his ideology. I mean, because it just kills me. I don't understand, where the ideology comes from when, we're sitting here and we're working our behinds off and we're not benefiting.
Alex, we hear it. Let me bring it to the Nobel Prize winner, Edmund Phelps. Alex is working in the warehouse. He aspires to be that professional, but he's not there. He's got no stability, he says. He's longing for some. All right, you've got the Nobel Prize. How do you advise him to look at this?
Well, I think you should look across at other countries, and in Europe, there's a whole class of people who don't have any jobs at all. They insist upon stability, but on those terms, employers simply can't afford to hire them. And that's with quite a few job subsidies. So it's a comparative thing.
So it must be hard sometimes as an economist, because essentially, are you describing Alex's circumstances, which he's really not happy about, as the price of productivity and wealth creation, even if it's not flowing directly to him? It's like, this is your function in American capitalism. It could be worse, so just go back to work, Alex.
No. I don't. No. As we started to say before, I think there's a huge role to be played by low-wage employment subsidies to pick up the demand for labor in the less skilled jobs, and that would increase the stability of those jobs, reduce their precariousness. There's a huge role for that. We've already covered that point.
Mm-hmm.
I was just pointing out that if you think things are bad here, you should look overseas where there is mass unemployment in the suburbs around Paris and mass unemployment in the south of France around Marseille and very high unemployment rates in Germany as well and Spain. While I wish things were much better for the low-wage worker, and I've worked hard on a program that would make them better,
mm-hmm.
I think comparatively speaking, the American worker is doing better here than overseas.
Let me take another call. Stephanie from Boston. Hi, Stephanie. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I want to bring to the discussion something that that never quite been brought up before. To give you a little background, I'm a knowledge worker who came to this country from Hong Kong about 10 years ago.
Okay.
So I grew up in Hong Kong, and after I came to this country, I saw such a stark difference between what I saw when I was growing up and in Hong Kong and here in the United States.
Hong Kong, a very wide-open economy, very freewheeling.
Because all the time you hear people, talk and, contrast between the free market and capitalism in the United States versus, the social capitalism in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But you cannot find a country or a place that is more free market and capitalistic than Hong Kong. And I'll tell you what my take on it. The government in Hong Kong has done a few things, which is right, which is to provide the infrastructure. By the infrastructure, I mean the basic health care, the infrastructures for, public housing to take care of the housing needs for the lower strata of the people.
Right.
And to provide the infrastructures of, sewage, transportation, and so on. Everything else, you leave it to the markets to take care of.
Would you recommend that for the United States, Stephanie? You've been here 10 years now.
Taxes. Now, what I'm saying, I'm not saying that is the only way, but, I'm just, trying to bring up to the table and what I saw in United States, which is that I came here and I was so surprised at how dismal the public housing is in the United States, and I was wondering why. And I look at the education systems, and everybody has complaining left and right about this and is not doing the right thing and the kids are going down and so on. And I contrasted what I saw in Hong Kong. I'm not saying the cookie cutter systems that mm-hmm. that I grew up in Hong Kong, is the right way. But what I'm saying is if the government has done a decent job, given the huge budget that it has, mm-hmm. and cut down the bureaucracy, and leave everything else, and cut down the regulations on what the market, should have been done, and all those pork barrels, this country would have been a lot better than it would have been now.
Maybe we could have a freer market and a better lifestyle. Robert Reich, there's a couple of different perspectives. Alex, who feels enslaved in his warehouse job, can't figure out how to get out of it. Stephanie comes from Hong Kong and says, you don't really have that freewheeling free market here. You could do a lot better and have a good life.
Well, undoubtedly, Stephanie is correct. A lot of the insecurity and stress that people like Alex and Sam and others who have been on the show feel has to do with the fact that if you lose your job, you lose your health insurance. Many people don't even have health insurance on the job anymore. Many people don't have pensions any longer. They used to have pensions on the job. Unemployment insurance used to cover about 70% of workers who lost their jobs in the United States. Now we're down to about 35% because so many people are working part-time or moving from job to job. They no longer qualify for unemployment insurance when they lose their job. So the whole infrastructure that Stephanie is talking about needs a lot of building up in this country if we are to really be dynamic in the sense of giving everybody an opportunity to get ahead. And also, when they, through no fault of their own, are out of a job, that they don't sink.
Mm. Edmund Phelps, how about it? You're very clear in saying that actual capitalism departs very often from well-functioning capitalism, that it's quoting you, the seeds of its own encrustation with entrenched power, you know, come along with the innovation. What report card do you give the American economy, I guess, and its governance today, but in terms of, you know, how well is it doing compared to the model you'd like to see, and how well is it, dancing with the government in terms of the supports that humanize and make it livable?
Yeah, well, I certainly agree with the with one or two of the listeners who were saying that we fall down very badly when it comes to some social infrastructure. We don't have a good social insurance system here from the point of view of its availability to the poor, and I'm sure there's room for enormous improvement on the housing side, as the caller from Hong Kong was saying. Mm. But that's a little bit off the subject of capitalism. What I'm trying to say is we've done one thing right, or pretty much right, and we put a lot of emphasis upon entrepreneurship, mm-hmm. and a good financial sector, and in doing that, we've done much better than other economies with respect to innovation, interestingness of work, productivity, and something we didn't get to talk about, but high employment is another of the benefits of that innovativeness. Could I just say, go back to one caller that I didn't get a chance to respond to? Mm-hmm. He was saying that his girlfriend liked to say that she works to live; she doesn't live to work.
Right.
But you know, for most people, work is a terribly important part of life. You can't just say that the job is just a way of earning a paycheck. And another thing, I get the impression from some of the callers that they think, oh, well, that might apply, that this idea that work can be exciting and a source of personal development, mm-hmm. and so forth, that might apply to some upper class or upper category of jobs, but there's nothing like that in the lower down and
down the line.
But I disagree.
Yeah.
I think there are problems to be solved in every job in a dynamic economy. Maybe not every job, but most jobs present challenges, change, problem solving. They provide some degree of engagement.
So celebrate that. Grab onto that and appreciate it, you're saying.
That's right. That's right. And could I just say very briefly to Secretary Reich, I think the OECD studies that he was referring to also put France and Italy lower than the U.S. and Canada in terms of life satisfaction, not just job satisfaction.
Robert Reich, what about this picture Edmund Phelps describes, a kind of whole capitalist culture here as permeated, maybe in different degree, but still rich with this notion of innovation and challenge that extends into the workplace, that people have a more excited sense of what's possible there than in Europe, and there's value in that, he says.
Well, let me just say again, I have enormous respect for Professor Phelps and for his research, and the accolades he's received are enormous. Well, they're just absolutely justifiable. But in terms of the view of what's happening to the American workforce, what most workers are experiencing, I just don't agree. Everything I've seen, everything I've read, every survey, every experience I've had as Secretary of Labor before and after, I see a workforce that is under enormous stress. Most people, it would be wonderful if they loved their work, or wonderful if they got satisfaction out of their work, and maybe if their employers understood how to manage better, they would. But most people don't like their work. Most people are living for vacations or for weekends or for times that they don't have to be at work. If you could give people more security and more of a sense that they would just have a little bit more spare change, most people would take that, even at the cost of higher unemployment, a little bit. Now, I don't think most people want the European system in America, but if we can just go back to that contrast, which I think is a fascinating contrast, most Europeans in the surveys I've seen, in the focus groups that I've seen, in my own experience, most Europeans like their lives. In terms of what one of our callers said, they do work to live. Productivity in France, for example, on an hourly basis, in terms of actually what people are doing when they are working, is not bad. It's not particularly low. It's comparable, roughly comparable to the United States, but it's just that a lot of people in France don't work all that many hours a week. Some of them cannot work, they can't get jobs, but some of them choose not to work that hard. And that's their choice. That's their business. If they want to do that, well, more power to them.
We're looking out of our foxhole here, and it's a fascinating view. Let me get one more call from John in Windham, New Hampshire. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, John. Thanks for I'm sorry, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm actually a loan officer, and this conversation has been very interesting to me. I've seen over the past several years the government, or Fannie Mae actually, allow debt load to increase considerably, and I'm privy to a lot of people's financial data.
This is what individuals are borrowing.
That's right, and I'm seeing that you know, they're allowed to borrow right now way over 50% of their total monthly you know, income.
Wow.
And that's just to cover minimum payments.
Right.
So I think we work to pay our debt, and I think that, that we're a debt-driven economy. And having just recently come back from a sabbatical in Germany, I know that most people over there don't carry credit cards. They don't have debt, and many people have multi-generational homes, so they don't even have mortgages. They're living in their grandparents' home.
Yeah, a different picture, and there's the loan officer speaking. John, thanks for calling. Edmund Phelps, our time grows short, but you look at debt, not so much that I've seen the individual, but government debt you pay a lot of attention to. You say there's too much wealth sloshing around the American economy. You say we need to raise taxes to sop up some of that government debt. That doesn't sound like what we think of as a free market, you know, hard bar.
Well, I think you can run surpluses or you can run deficits. It doesn't make you more or less of a free market economy. By the way, I don't like that term, free market. I think the government has enormous responsibilities to carry out in the area of regulation and the support of social infrastructure and so forth. I'm simply concerned that I want us to appreciate the importance of capitalism for the private sector. And I certainly agree that the public sector has a lot of work cut out for it to do. I would ask, since I have this opportunity, I would ask Secretary Reich why he didn't get behind low-wage employment subsidies when he was Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration. That disappointed me very much. I thought at last Joe Lunchpail had found a friend there, and nothing happened.
Bob Reich, we've got 1 minute. You're on the spot. Why weren't you there for the low-wage subsidies?
Actually, we enacted the most significant low-wage subsidy and the largest low-wage subsidy ever enacted in the history of the United States, and that's called the Earned Income Tax Credit. It was expanded under the Clinton administration. It is now the largest anti-poverty policy in the United States. It provides low-wage workers with a major subsidy that ideally, if it were expanded as much as I think it should be, would lift them all over the poverty line. There is no excuse in this country for having people who are working but still poor.
Edmund Phelps.
Yeah, but the EITC was and is still mainly directed at the parents of dependent children. There are a whole bunch of single men out there who don't benefit from it.
No, the EITC is now single men can qualify for the ITC. That's one of the things that was changed.
Word of time today. We can see there's a lot more to be said here. I hope we get a chance to do it one day. Edmund Phelps, congratulations again on your Nobel Prize, and thank you so much for being with us today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor. Bob Reich, thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.